Audio clips from the book, The Forgotten Mysteries of Atlantis. In 1993 and 2011, after being imprisoned by the Dark Forces for 10 years, L intervened and set the Seeker free. He was then free to work further on his karma and the destiny that involved many people in a deep and long-lasting imprisonment by these forces. But, starting at the beginning, in 1992, following an inspiration, my friend the Seeker had traveled to Ireland. He hired a car at Dublin Airport and drove to Galway, on the west coast of Ireland. The journey had to start in this area, an area that once was a part of the sunken continent of Atlantis, an area where the old Gaelic language still is spoken. On his return journey from Galway, travelling back to Dublin, he stopped his car at the junction of Ballinasloe. A doubt had entered his mind, a feeling that something was important. He wondered where to go, which way to travel. He sensed a call, important to both himself and others. Should he choose the shorter way to Dublin through Athlone, or the longer northern route through Langford? He stopped his car in a desolate place, surrounded by turfs and flatlands. As he stepped out to consider what route to choose, the gentle wind took hold of his hair, caressed his skin, as if the country itself, the whole place, welcomed him. The rain had ceased, the air felt pleasant. The smell of the water-soaked turfs felt rejuvenating. He stood there at the junction, completely alone. Then something unusual happened. A movement in the left periphery of his eyes caught his attention, and he turned his head slightly towards this movement. Two entities were coming towards him. It seemed as two men were approaching, but he knew it was not so. He looked somewhat amazed at the two menlings, the human-like creatures. They were not ordinary men, although they were shaped as such. They were two very small men, which proved later to be purebred leprechauns, native to Ireland, who in Norway are called gnomer or nissa. They wore clothes that were used some 100 years ago. They had solid boots and green trousers. The jacket was with upturned sleeves, and on their heads they wore hats with feathers sticking up like they use today in Tyrol, Austria. The leprechauns stopped a few meters away and looked directly at him. Then, without a word, without saying anything, they both lifted their right arm, simultaneously, and pointed vigorously with a strong intent in a southwestern direction, just the opposite to the northern way he was considering to travel. Luckily he knew that in the etheric realm of reality, in which the leprechauns obviously existed, all things are reversed, as seen in a mirror, which indicated that they were actually pointing towards northeast, towards the northern way. Then suddenly, they were gone, and there he stood, left alone once more. However, he was now sure that he must take the northern route, understanding that it was of great importance to travel in this direction. He had known for years the people that lived in the other realm. In his home country they were well known, and the Norwegians knew that there were many different kinds of such beings. There were Nissa, Dvergr, Troll, Haldra, Nokken, Drajan, Granger, Elva, Noma, Silfor, and within each group there were many variations. He had once written a poem to praise these beings. In this poem he had called them the Under-Earthlings. This was not the first time creatures from the etheric realm had showed themselves to him. The more important it was that he received and understood the message they were supposed to give, the more physical the etheric entities usually appeared. This time they were almost totally physical. It was like they were made of flesh and bones. He remembered one time when a huge Drajan, in English called Kraken, had appeared in front of him. It later showed that this creature had actually saved his life. He had, at that time, a 23-foot wooden boat, with a WFM motor. Norwegian indoor engine, gasoline-driven, two-stroke cylinder, 5 horsepower. It was late autumn and he had taken a day off from work to sail the boat to its winter place. The route he was taking was quite hazardous. It passed a rocky part of the Norwegian coast where many sailors had drowned, and many a small boat had been taken by the waves. This area was also an old initiation place for Nordic shamans, and was hundreds of years old. A labyrinth, called a Troy Castle, had been made and was situated in this area. What is a Troy Castle? For more than 6,000 years ago, there was a great and catastrophically drought in the area north of the Caspian Sea. This period lasted for 2,000 years and led to wanderings of the people living there to the west and northwest. Without the use of the horse, this movement would have been impossible, and on horseback, these people changed the European history for all time. They came to Europe in three great waves, just parted by a few hundred years between each, and 5,000 years ago these people had influenced the greater parts of Europe and South Scandinavia. 4,000 years ago also the British Islands and Iberia, Spain/Portugal was part of their sphere. Everywhere these people came to dominate. The old gods representing fertility and female qualities, the moon cults, Ezine, were exchanged with the war hero on horseback. Odin, the sun cults, Ezine, coming from the area of Azerbaijan. The so-called Troy castles are other signs or indications that Asian tradition thinking was known in Europe long ago. Close to my home in the Norway coastal town of Sandefjord is a marine peninsula called Osterøya, East Island. About 1,000 years ago, this land was separated from the mainland. It a real island, with a narrow strait used by the Vikings as they sailed between the two main cities of Norway at that time, Korpanger and Tunsborg. On southern part of the peninsula there is an area called Yksni. A part of Yksni forms a separate and smaller peninsula as an appendix to the main peninsula, Truba Headland, Trubarodden. Two small fjords, the South and Trubafjord, form this headland. Between these small fjords there is a quitismus, id, over which one can walk out to the headland of Truba. Up to year 1800. A strange man-made stone formation was visible on this isthmus. Was a row of stones placed in a special pattern to form a labyrinth. This labyrinth has given the name to the area, as such constructions are called labyrinths of Troy, in this special case, Truba. Several labyrinths like the one near Sandefjord are known in Europe, especially in Scandinavia. From ancient times, these constructions have been called labyrinths of Troy. Variations of this name, such as Troynborg, Treborg, Trelleborg, Troytown, are found all over Europe. The origin of the name lies in the mighty old city of Troy. Why this name is connected with the labyrinth is uncertain, but we may see some relationships if we investigate the ancient culture of Troy. Homer's Iliad describes in detail the fierce war between Sparta and Troy. At that time, Troy was the most western outpost of Eastern philosophy and thinking, while Sparta was more western orientated. The people, reed prince, of Troy had captured and imprisoned Helen, the beautiful princess of Sparta. After several years of fighting, Helen's followers set her free. They managed to conquer them by the help of a giant hollow wooden horse, in the belly of which they managed to get into the city. Via the wooden horse, the Western way of thinking got access to the Eastern philosophy. As we will see later, the constructors of the Troy castles possibly were Oriental horse warriors that rode from the East during the time population migrations and settled in different parts of Europe, especially Scandinavia. With regards to the Troy castles, there are usually myths about horses, showing that the parallel to the Iliad may be of some value, at least of some interest. Much which has been written over the years about the Troy castles often mention visions or myths of black horses in connection with the labyrinths. In Sandefjord, seamen tell stories about seeing a couple of black horses just before bad weather or storms. Such visions usually made the seamen return to shore. This has also happened to me once. If I had not returned at that moment, my boat would undoubtedly have been wrecked in the oncoming storm. A glowing castle has also been observed several times at the headland. Most of the labyrinths have several other stories associated with them. These stories include the ability to warn of storms, or that a ritual held in the labyrinth would prevent wreckage and guarantee a good catch of fish, as the fishermen would have more power over the winds and the movements of the seawater, as well as over the fish. Most scientists are also convinced, Cone Board, Lawrence Berg, that there were rites connected to the labyrinths, rites to prepare the seamen to cope with bad weather fish catches, or horsemen to manage and tame horses. The same scientists has also agreed on the age of these labyrinths and dated then to 1500-500 BC. As earlier mentioned, it is highly possible that the builders of these labyrinths were Asian shamans who came together with Mongolian conquerors on horseback during or before the times of the folk migrations. This was the way he had to sail, out into the open sea, passing the rocky area with the Troy Castle, and then into a more quiet fjord, Sandifjordsfjorden, where the boat was intended to rest during the winter. As he sailed the boat out into the sea, the wind became stronger and stronger. The boat was lifted up by the swell of the peaking waves, and crashed down in the troughs. The engine worked hard, and the small boat stamped in the rough sea. The weather became more and more hostile, almost stormy, but he continued on. After a while he reached the area of Truba, and just before he was to enter the most dangerous part of the route, something totally unexpected and unbelievable happened. A huge hand, exactly as shown in the picture below, appeared out of the sea, coming up from the depths. The water was running down the fingers, seaweed was hanging from the nails. It was a totally natural and physical hand, apart from the fact that it was around 8-10 meters high. No arm was to be seen, no body, no head or face, just this enormous hand. Then the hand started slowly to beckon to him, as if it wanted him to follow, asking him to come down into the depths of the ocean. He was well acquainted with old Scandinavian folklore and immediately understood that it was the hand of Drajan, calling him to his death, to drowning. In a flash he instantly realized his predicament and made a fast decision, a decision made without hesitation or fear. He turned the boat and sailed with the wind back to the summer anchor place. As he traveled with the waves and the wind, this part of the journey took only a short time, perhaps 15 minutes. A few days later, when the weather was calm and still, he tried again to sail the boat to its intended winter place. After just 10 minutes the engine stopped. There was no more fuel. He had totally forgotten to check the level of the gas. If he had continued on his route that stormy day, the fuel would have ended exactly at the most dangerous spot of the route. The boat would surely have been destroyed, splintering on the rocks and sinking. He would have been lucky to survive. The hand of Drajan had saved him. 21 years later, when traveling on the Hurtigruten, a postal boat going from Bergen to the northern border of Russia, a voyage that takes 7 days one way, he found a picture from old Norwegian tradition, showing exactly the same situation. This must have been known from old times. So, standing there at this junction in Ireland, he knew, from previous experiences, that when he saw the leprechauns in such physical reality, they brought him a very important message, a life-important message. He was totally convinced, he had to travel the northern route, he had to travel this way. He sensed that it was vital to travel this way. Getting into the car, he started the engine and went off in the northeastern direction towards Longford. The landscape in this area was typically Irish, with small rolling turf-covered hills, clusters of trees, stone houses, abandoned farmsteads and the occasional modern house dotted about in the surrounding area. Cows were grazing, the sky was blue and all was quiet. After about 90 minutes of driving, just before he came to Longford, he spotted a grass fire on the left side of the road, about 200 meters away. The flames were high, fierce, and it seemed that the fire was out of control. He stopped the car at a small passing place on the right side of the road, rolled down the window and looked out. Again something unexpected happened. The flames shot up in the air, changed direction and came directly towards the car. They entered through the open window and made a spiraling movement around him, encircling his head and upper body. He was not burned nor did he feel any discomfort, he only felt a strange feeling of being invaded by something. He was immediately transported to another realm of existence. For how long was he gone? Where was he? It was impossible to answer, but this experience was of deep and significant importance, full of meaning that initiated a development which was to continue for years, influencing the fate of many. What was this experience? He was thrown into a state of complete and total communication with the entire cosmos, on all levels. His thoughts were crystal clear, understanding everything. His feelings were totally transparent, encompassing all and everything in a love so deep and warm that he never thought was possible. His will was as if he could reach the highest mountain top and overcome the most difficult task. He was the entire cosmos. He was one with God. Eventually he came out of this experience, and slipped back to the ordinary world. Exhilarated and dazed at the totality of such a cosmic experience, the ordinary world felt so dull, so grey, so disappointing, so depressive. One special and interesting feature about this experience, and actually all the other supernatural or spiritual experiences described in this book, is that they are impossible to remember exactly. My friend the Seeker put it this way: when I think back on all these experiences, all I remember is the impression I had after the experience was over, after it had ended. I never remember the actual experience in detail. I do have a recollection of some of the pictures, of the insights, but the details have vanished as if it was in a dream. This fact leaves me with an uncertainty, a feeling that it did not really happen, that it was only a memory of something else. However, when I focus on the situation and relive the experience, feeling the huge impression it left upon my soul, I have never doubted that what I experienced was real. This forgetting all details of what happens when one is in the spiritual world can also be a problem in my work as a healer and veterinarian, the Seeker continued. I always make a pulse diagnosis on my patients, and immediately after doing this type of diagnosis, I forget the results. Often this forgetfulness makes the animal owners irritated, but there is nothing I can do about it. What is pulse diagnosis? Pulse diagnosis is a very old method of diagnosing, used in China for thousands of years. This method may seem incredible, nonsensical or fraudulent for Western scientific mind. It is none of these. In skilled hands, it is a power diagnostic method. General comments: proper pulse taking requires a proper state of mind. This mindset is similar to a form of meditation, or a state of daydreaming. Typically, a practitioner in a state is producing mainly alpha brain waves. There are at least three conditions that can help a practitioner to achieve this meditative state, a state in which detachment or disassociation is crucial. Not caring. The practitioner must not have preconceptions of the causes. He must shed all interest, anxiety or desire to reach a diagnosis, to paid at the end of the treatment, or any other mundane matters. Many find this to be the most difficult aspect of the requirements, but this state is fundamental to achieving a meditative state. Simply put, it is living in exact moment of the pulse and of being conscious of little else. Not mind wandering. At the moment of the pulse taking, one should concentrate totally and exclusively on the patient. One's mental focus should exclude everything and everyone else that may try to enter or mind or field of consciousness. Not acting. This is the state that some refer to as the state of fuzzy sight, is similar to the moments when exhaustion begins to set in and the gaze into the far distance. In this state, one finds it difficult to concentrate on other things. Therefore one does not act, or attains the state of acting. Practical pulse taking in animals. The Seeker learned how to take the pulse in humans from his benefactor, Dr. Georg Benz. As a veterinarian, he always thought about the possibility to do this also in veterinary medicine. But how to take the pulse in animals was for a long time mystery for him. Then, by sheer luck, the searcher met Dr. Malka de Vlieg in Belgium. He is a pediatrician, working with pulse diagnosis in children. One day he had observed that when the child was in contact with its mother, the pulse changed drastically, the heart pulse of the child disappeared, and knowing that the mother was suffering from a serious heart condition, he understood the connection. The pulse of the mother influenced the pulses of the child. When the seeker was told about this, he instantly understood the importance of this discovery in his search for a technique to monitor the pulse in animals. It was only to monitor the changes in the human pulse, owner or himself, as the human was in contact, either physically or mentally, with the animal. This method he refined over the years, and it will be explained below. First of all, we must prepare our mind to step out of the physical realm and enter the spiritual world. In the spiritual world, the laws are quite different from the physical world. Time and space do not exist. When in this mindset, focusing our intention on the animal, we get the pulse of the animal. When we focus our mind on past times, we get the pulse of that animal in past times. In such a way, we may make a full energetic or spiritual diagnosis of the human or animal patient. Does this sound strange to you? This phenomenon is described by many observers up through history, by the Indians, the Oriental people, and by several observers from the Occident. Rudolf Steiner describes how married couples get a common etheric body after some time, and to get back to one's own etheric body after divorce or death, it takes 3 years. That is why a widow or a widower should stay single for at least 3 years. Modern science has recently brought this phenomenon to our attention. Scientists have shown that neuronal activity in one brain is transmitted to another brain, long as this other brain is concentrated on the first individual. This is called jumping neurons. For several weeks he felt depressed. Deep depression often emerges after such spiritual experiences because the memory of them quickly fades away. As they disappear, they leave only emptiness and longing for what was. Also, they never repeat themselves, they just fade into the bosom of the spiritual world. Some months later, in the late autumn, when our friend the seeker was safe back in his homeland Norway, the telephone rang. A man from Stockholm was calling and, without much small talk or explanation, told him the following: "I represent a group of Swedes that are in telepathic contact with a group of old, not incarnated Atlanteans." The expression "not incarnated old Atlanteans" means the following souls of the people that lived in old Atlantis, who are at present no incarnated in living, physical, earthly bodies like you and I. Of course, most of us have been living in old Atlantis, but have moved on and experienced many incarnations since then. Some souls that lived in old Atlantis have not incarnated since the time of the Great Flood, mainly because of their unpleasant karma due to use of black magic. These souls are called not incarnated old Atlanteans. The message from the old Atlanteans was as follows: "We have been told, by even higher spirits I guess, to tell you that you worked in old Atlantis, as the leader of a group of people connected to a pyramid. This pyramid was situated in the eastern part of Atlantis, present-day Ireland. You were working there as an oracle, and as this oracle you had the ability to have absolute and total contact with the entire cosmos." The man from Stockholm did not say much more. He just told this. Why did these old Atlanteans bring forth this message to our friend the seeker? There is one obvious explanation that our friend the seeker realized 20 years later, that the heavy karma of these old Atlanteans, his old friends and co-workers of the pyramid, was mainly due to actions they and he had done in their work as priests in the Atlantean pyramid. Many of the priests that had committed great sins in those times had not dared to reincarnate. Our friend the seeker had dared this, and had worked through his unpleasant karma. He had managed to repay his debts. The other souls then saw hope for themselves if our friend the seeker managed to fulfill his karma. That was why it was so important for them to make the seeker aware that he had been working in the pyramids of eastern Atlantis. By doing this, they were hoping that he could help them and give them light in the darkness they had put themselves in. Edgar Cayce has written and spoken a great deal about this problem with the not incarnated Atlanteans. Our friend the seeker did not ask any questions. He just received the message. He did not tell this to anybody, at least for many years. The few he did reveal this story to in later times made no comments at all. Not much was to be said, they just had an empty look in their eyes. 20 years passed. Who was Edgar Cayce? Edgar Cayce, pronounced Casey, 1877-1945, has been called the sleeping prophet, the father of holistic medicine, one and the most documented psychic of the 20th century. For more than 40 years of his adult life, Cayce gave psychic readings to thousands of seekers while in an unconscious state, diagnosing illnesses and revealing lives lived in the past and prophecies yet to come. But who exactly was Edgar Cayce? Cayce was born on a farm in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, in 1877, and his psychic abilities began to appear as early as his childhood. He was able to see and talk to his late grandfather's spirit, and often played with imaginary friends whom he said were spirits on the other side. He also displayed an uncanny ability to memorize the pages of a book simply by sleeping on it. These gifts labeled the young Cayce as strange, but all Cayce really wanted was to help others, especially children. Later in life, Cayce would find that he had the ability to put himself into a sleep-like state by lying down on a couch, closing his eyes, and folding his hands over his stomach. In this state of relaxation and meditation, he was able to place his mind in contact with all time and space, the universal consciousness, also known as the superconscious mind. From there, he could respond to questions as broad as, "What are the secrets of the universe? And what is my purpose in life?" to as specific as, "What can I do to help my arthritis? And how were the pyramids of Egypt built?" His responses to these questions came to be called nerdings, and their insights offer practical help and advice to individuals even today. Many people are surprised to learn that Edgar Cayce was a devoted churchgoer and Sunday school teacher. At a young age, Cayce vowed to read the Bible for every year of his life, and at the time of his death in 1945, he had accomplished this task. Perhaps the readings said it best. When asked how to become psychic, Cayce's advice was to become more spiritual. Although Cayce died more than 60 years ago, the timeliness of the material in the readings, with subjects like discovering your mission in life, developing your intuition, exploring ancient mysteries, and taking responsibility for your health, is evidenced by the hundreds of books that have been written on the various aspects of this work, as well as the dozen or so titles focusing on Cayce's life itself. Together, these books contain information so valuable that even Edgar Cayce himself might have hesitated to predict their impact on the contemporary world. In 1945, the year of his passing, who could have known those terms such as meditation, Akashic records, spiritual growth, auras, soulmates, and holistic health, would become household words to millions. The majority of Edgar Cayce's readings deal with holistic health and the treatment of illness. As it was at the time Cayce was giving readings, still today, individuals from all walks of life and belief receive physical relief from illnesses or ailments through information given in the readings. Some readings were given as far back as 100 years ago. Yet, although best known for this material, the sleeping Cayce did not seem to be limited to concerns about the physical body. In fact, in their entirety, the readings discuss an astonishing 10,000 different topics. This vast array of subject matter can be narrowed down into a smaller group of topics that, when compiled together, deal with the following five categories: 1. Health-related information, 2. Philosophy and reincarnation, 3. Dreams and dream interpretation, 4. ESP and psychic phenomena, and 5. Spiritual growth, meditation, and prayer. Further details of Cayce's life and work are explored in his classic book, There A River, 1942, by Thomas Sugrue, available in hardback, paperback, or audiobook versions. Then is An Old Map of Atlantis, Part 2, The Calling of the Wounded Healer. The Three Demons. Years went by. Almost 20 years. Life had taught him many things, taken away many illusions. Wives had come and gone. Then, one day, El brought him in contact with a shaman who wanted to help him on his way. The shaman was clairvoyant and immediately told him that before he could guide him through and into the spiritual world, before he could lead him on his spiritual travel into the higher realms of existence, our friend the seeker had to ask for forgiveness for a great sin.